the Montreal Protocol really straightened things out worldwide. That was probably the best agreement that the world ever came to. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, Paul, there's a People's Republic of China. You know, I don't want to go on a rant to anyone. You know, it's not a democracy. It's a one-party system. And a lot of times they say things that aren't quite true. They agree to a lot of things, and then they tend not to do them. And when you point out that they haven't done them, they apologize and promise to do them, and then they don't do them. So, I mean, if any of you guys are interested in holding your breath, waiting for the CFC 11 to drop from China, don't do that, because I'm not that optimistic. You know, hopefully there'll be some force produced that will kind of incline them to actually be good citizens. But at this point, I don't think we have any chips, and I don't know if the Europeans have any chips to play. So they might just kind of yes us to death, as the old saying goes.
Anywhere in that article, does it say what they're using CFC 11 for? You know, I mean, R12 was big in refrigeration forever, but CFC 11 was used in big centrifugal units for air conditioning, you know, big buildings and things, skyscrapers. Did they say what they're using it for?
No, they're not. I mean, they mention in the article that the different things that you can do with it is refrigeration, also in the production of foam material it seems to be used. The problem is that these are internal factories deep in China. And it's a government that doesn't let external regulatory agencies anywhere near it, and they tend to be vague on top of that. So we don't know where exactly it is. We know the general geographic location. We don't know what company is doing it. We don't know what they're trying to use it for, that it's leaking into the to the atmosphere. There's a lot more questions than there are answers, unfortunately.
Okay, you know, the ozone layer was, that hole in Antarctica is starting to shrink. I've seen that recently. And, you know, of course, we've got larger and larger, and they have graphs, and they show since they slowed things down after the 1989 Montreal Protocol, they show graphs that are steadily decreasing the amount of ozone that's up there. Really caused from the chlorine and the chlorine splits when it gets involved with the ultraviolet light, and then it attacks the ozone, and that's all changed. You know, the hole is starting to shrink, and it was going in the right direction. So that doesn't sound good. I haven't heard this report at all, Brian.
Okay, Paul, it's good that I picked it. Well, generally, it's closing up, but the rate of it closing has kind of stalled and slowed down. And again, that's because you can't police the world, unfortunately. You can try, but not successfully. And so, you know, who knows if there's a couple of factories in India that are using CFC 11. I wouldn't put it past that country either. You know, they'll come up with great rationalizations that they're poorer countries than we are, so they don't have the liberty of saving the world, so they have to feed themselves. And there's all kinds of wonderful rationalizations for being a bad actor.
Yeah, I thought everybody got rid of it. I remember walking through the machine rooms, actually working in the machine rooms and skyscrapers, and you'd see 55-gallon drums of, you know, they were orange tanks, and that meant it was a CFC 11. Well, all over the place. I mean, you know, and this is worldwide, and that is supposed to be all gone. And from your report, apparently it's not all gone. Wow. All right, this is WS2N. Back to you, Roy. AC2GS WS2N.
Yeah, Paul. I mean, I haven't checked, but I wonder if you go to Alibaba and such, you can find cartons of the stuff, you know, containers full of the stuff. It would be interesting. I think that they're a little bit closed off with that. They don't really show they're doing that stuff. But in big companies, they get away with murder over there. It's just the growth. You know, I mean, China is a fascinating subject. There's all kinds of strange things going on with China. They have an enormous real estate bubble that makes United States real estate bubbles in the past seem simple and easy and non-dangerous. They have enormous apartment complexes that were built and never occupied, and they're just rotting away. And they're just exchanged like tokens back and forth, and they raise the price of them. It's a very confusing country. Anyway, on to the next story. Geologists in France and Italy have spotted what appears to be organic molecules from outer space in 3.3 billion year old rocks in South Africa, according to a new study. By now we know that organic molecules from methane to amino acids exist in space, and perhaps some of these molecules were brought to our own planet via carbon-containing asteroids. Scientists studying ancient rocks in South Africa seem to have uncovered evidence of the oldest examples yet of these extraterrestrial molecules. A small range called the Maconia Mountains of the Barberton Greenstone Belt sits in the eastern South Africa and Swaziland, and contains a 23 to 60 foot thick deposit of 3.3 billion year old volcanic rock called Josiso Chert. Among layers of the volcanic ash lie carbon-filled layers deposited during times of lower volcanic activity, and the whole region appears to have been altered by the presence of water. According to the paper published in the journal Geochima et Cosmochima Acta, I don't know what language that's in. The researchers analyzed a pair of postage stamp size samples gathered during a field campaign, slicing them into a few dozen pieces and analyzed them with an electron microscope. Protons from a particle accelerator and continuous wave electron paramagnetic resonance. In essence, the researchers measured how the sample's electrons responded to a slowly changing magnetic field. They found different kinds of signals in the slices. Most of them corresponded with carbon signals found elsewhere on Earth, but on one slice, it looked like the signal from carbon-containing meteorites. It didn't surprise the researchers to find extraterrestrial material in their sediment, as they do today. Micrometeorites likely fell on ancient Earth, bringing organic carbon molecules. What did surprise them is that somehow there were enough of these materials present in the area to still be detectable after 3.3 billion years. They proposed that maybe the layer they analyzed formed after the meteor impact produced a layer of... Scientists report that finding layers of extraterrestrial organic carbon from asteroids might complicate efforts to find similar-looking biosignatures, as it might look like the signatures of life. Research continues to show that our planet's rocks preserve an incredible history, not just our own history, but the history of...
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
You probably lost about 10 seconds, Roy.
No harm, no foul. So basically, there are organic molecules dropping in on us from asteroids as far back as 3 billion years ago. So if we find organic material on planets, they might have been seeded by similar asteroids. So go figure. Okay, on to the next. In the middle of a rapidly intensifying fight between the United States and Peking over Chinese telecom giant Huawei, the Department of Homeland Security warned companies on data security risks if they use commercial drones made in China, according to reports from CyberScoop and Politico. The DHS's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency warns U.S. companies to be cautious of Chinese-built drones as they may contain components that can compromise their data and share your information on a server accessed beyond the company itself. The Chinese company DJI is the world's biggest drone company by far. In 2017, U.S. Homeland Security officials issued a similar memo claiming it had moderate confidence that DJI's drones and software are, quote, providing U.S. critical infrastructure and law enforcement data to the Chinese government, end quote, citing a reliable source, quote, with first and second-hand access, end quote. DJI denied that the 2017 report. There is no public evidence available to support the American claim of Chinese. Safety is at the core of everything we do. The security of our technology has been independently verified by the U.S. government and leading U.S. businesses, end quote. DJI spokesperson assured the press, quote, we give customers full and complete control over how their data is collected, stored, and transmitted. For government and critical infrastructure customers, that requires additional assurances. We provide drones that do not transfer data to DJI or via the Internet, and our customers can enable all precautions DHS recommends. Let me drop for a sec. In 2018, DJI contracted an American company to conduct an independent analysis of the company's data and security practices. The report from the San Francisco-based Kivu Consulting defended DJI's handling of data storage, flight logs, and personally indefinable information. Homeland Security officials have spent much of 2019 pressing Chinese spying theories. Quote, Russia's trying to disrupt the system, end quote, Chris Krebs, director of CISA, said earlier this year, but China is trying to manipulate the system to ultimate long-term advantage. The renewed push against DJI is taking on new importance just days after an executive order from President Donald Trump pushed due ostensibly to national security concerns. On Monday, markets around the world have been thrown into chaos as investors have sent tech stocks plummeting while everyone figures out the long-term repercussions of recent events. The order against Huawei and warnings against DJI are part of what could be a genuine tech cold war. American action follows years of Chinese bans on U.S. tech companies, including Google and Facebook. The entire tech conflict is just one dimension of a larger fight that now characterizes the icy and escalating trade war between the United States and China. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, so you guys enjoy your DJI drones while you have them, because it looks like there's going to be some mess with them as well. Let me drop for a second, and then I'll move on to the next story. Some 3 million years ago, a tiny mouse featuring reddish fur on its back and a white belly scurried across the landscape of what is now Germany. We know this thanks to a remarkable new breakthrough in which reddish color pigment was detected in an ancient fossil, a scientific first. Fossils with traces of soft tissue are exceptionally rare, making it difficult, if not impossible, for scientists to determine the color of a specimen, the texture of its skin, and other important cosmetic and functional characteristics. Without this information, scientists can't be sure when a certain physical feature emerges in a species and how it evolved over time. New research published this past Tuesday in Nature Communications describes a new technique in which scientists, for the very first time, were able to detect reddish-colored pigments in a 3-million-year-old mouse fossil. Using X-ray spectroscopy, chemical imaging, and other techniques, researchers from the University of Manchester and several other institutions showed that the extinct field mouse had reddish to brown fur on the back and a white belly. Excitingly, the new technique could be used to detect reddish color on other fossils, retaining traces of soft tissue. The new study called for experts in physics, paleontology, and chemistry. A key challenge was to develop a new technique for discerning red color pigments in an ancient fossil. To do so, the researchers had to map the chemical elements associated with the pigment melanin, the dominant pigment in animals. For the color red, the version of melanin is called pheomelanin, And for the color black, it's called eumelanin. In fossils, the red pigment is rarer and more difficult to detect as it's less stable over vast timescales. Let me drop for a second. Prior to the new study, scientists had already developed a technique for detecting eumelanin in ancient fossils. This was done, for example, to show that the Archaeopteryx, an early bird-like dinosaur, had black feathers. Relatedly, Bristol University paleontologists used a similar approach to show that some dinosaurs had lighter coloring on their undersides and darker coloring on top, a form of camouflage known as countershading. 3 years ago, Nick Edwards, a co-author of the new study and a scientist at SLAC, National Accelerator Laboratory, showed that it was possible to distinguish eumelanin pigments from pheomelanin pigments in modern birds, a discovery that established important groundwork for the new study. Quote, "We had to build up a strong foundation using modern animal tissue before we could apply the technique to these ancient animals," quote, said Edwards in a SLAC statement. "It was really a tipping point in using chemical signatures to crack the coloring of ancient animals with soft tissue fossils." For the new analysis, the researchers used an extraordinary 3-million-year-old fossil of an Ex-plus hosum. The fossil dubbed Mighty Mouse was blasted by X-ray radiation at the Stanford synchrotron radiation light source at Diamond Light Source in the United Kingdom. This allowed the researchers to study the interactions of X-rays with the chemistry of the fossil. The trick was to spot the trace metals that were once present in the soft tissue of the living organism. Observations showed that the trace metals in the fossil bonded with the organic chemicals in the same way it does in living creatures with high concentrations of red pigment in their tissue. This results in the identification of pheomelanin in fossilized mouse fur. Excitingly, this new non-destructive technique could be used to study other fossils. Quote, "Resolution of pheomelanin pigment residue should now be possible using a combination of chemical imaging and X-ray spectroscopy, at least for specimens with an age equal to or less than 3 million years," the authors wrote in the study. Hopefully, these future efforts will continue to add color to what was once a monochrome past. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next. Human beings are curious creatures. We are seldom happy with what Mother Nature has provided and take it upon ourselves to improve upon nature. Well, we've been selectively breeding our domesticated animals and through the generations have pushed and pulled canines into all manner of forms for our own amusement. Actions, though, have consequences. As cute as dog breeds like French bulldogs look, to many people, it's long been thought that these dogs' distinctive compact skulls also make them very vulnerable to severe health and breathing issues. But new research out of Europe suggests that these mushy faces are only part of the problem for some breeds. An unrelated genetic mutation that also is found in these dogs without these skulls may be partly to blame as well. French bulldogs and similarly squished-head dogs such as the pugs are known as brachiocephalic dogs. Compared to dogs like, say, Labrador retrievers, now, these pups are bred to have incredibly flat noses and foreheads. Their compact skull, however, can often result in body parts like the palate or nostrils being too small. When that happens, the airflow can be obstructed and cause chronic breathing problems. The catch-all term for this phenomena is called brachiocephalic obstructive airway syndrome, or BOAS. A dog geneticist has long studied and tried to better understand BOAS in brachiocephalic dogs, but years ago he began hearing stories from breeders of the Norwich Terrier, a United Kingdom originated dog once bred to catch rodents. These dogs are coming down with symptoms remarkably similar to BOAS. While Norwich Terriers are definitely as small as a pug or a Frenchie, they're not brachiocephalic. That made him wonder if there was something similar shared across these different breeds, or if he was seeing two different diseases that were just looking very similar. Eventually, the researchers decided to coordinate with other researchers, including some who had spent decades collecting the DNA and examining airways of hundreds of Norwich Terriers to unravel the mystery. The fruits of their research, published a few weeks ago in PLOS Genetics, suggested that a specific mutation in a gene called ADAMTS3 can wholly explain the syndrome in Norwich Terriers. Terriers with the worst symptoms and tissue deformities, for instance, were usually dogs that had two copies of this mutation, indicating a clear cause and effect relationship. But interestingly enough, they're also found some mutations in the DNA of some English and French bulldogs. From Jean Present. Well, this discovery changes how we view respiratory disease predisposition in dogs, offers potential genetic screens, and highlights a new biological function for ADAMTS3, end quote, the authors wrote. The ADAMTS3 gene found in the 13th chromosome is thought to help in the development of the lymphatic system, the network of vessels and organs that ferry white blood cells and waste through the body as needed. Other mutations in ADAMTS3 in both dogs and humans have previously been linked to facial deformities and lymphatic vessel blockages, which can cause a buildup of fluid or swelling. This is only one study, so the research team plans to do follow-up research, possibly using dog cell lines in the lab to confirm their findings. But anecdotally, Norwich Terrier breeders who turned to his co-authors in Switzerland for help have been able to reduce the likelihood of the syndrome appearing in their dogs over time by identifying dogs that are more or less likely to develop the condition based on their breeding tests, and when they compared more recent populations of these dogs to older ones, the new dogs were less likely to carry the ADAMTS3 mutation. Quote, in the 90s, something like 80% of Norwich Terriers that came into their clinic had poor breathing and this mutation, but it decreased further and further over time. They don't know if, they don't know it at the time, but they were actually selecting against this thing that we think is causing this disease. Drop for 1 second. But even if ADAMTS3 does exclusively cause the Boas-like syndrome in Norwich Terriers, it's more complex. It's a more complex picture for bulldogs. If a French bulldog is conforming to the breed standard, then they have a certain degree of risk due to their skull shape alone. But there are other things that could be contributing to that risk, and this could be one of the things that may be segregating them into different levels of risk. But to what degree, we don't quite know yet, because of that, there needs to be more research looking directly at the link between ADAMTS3 and Boas in bulldogs. These would include studies where bulldog symptoms are measured against the amount of bad ADAMTS3 copies, similar to what was done in the study. There might also come a time when ADAMTS3 could be used to guide the treatment of bulldogs with Boas. Bulldogs with especially bad Boas often get corrective surgery to help them breathe easier, but we know already that the fluid buildup in the dog's airways with Boas is linked to worse recovery afterwards. So, if a dog's Boas is directly linked to this mutation, that could mean they won't respond as well to the treatment. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on with the next one, I guess. Buck Rogers apparently is alive and well, and he seems to be working for the Air Force. The U.S. Air Force announced only a few weeks ago that it had successfully used a ground-based surrogate for its laser weapons project, the Self-Protect High-Energy Laser Demonstrator, which they have a lovely acronym called SHIELD, to shoot down multiple air-launched missiles during a test at White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico. The system is designed to eventually be mounted on aircraft, where it could serve as a sort of instantaneous point defense system, shooting down inbound projectiles. For the drive, the laser itself is just one component of the planned final system, with other technologies such as a turreted mount and a pod to attach it to the side of an aircraft constituting separate projects. Quote, during the series of tests at the high-energy laser system test facility, the demonstrator laser weapon system, acting as a ground-based test surrogate for the SHIELD system, was able to engage, shoot down several air-launched missiles in flight, the Air Force wrote in a statement. The demonstration is an important step of the SHIELD system development by validating laser effectiveness against the target missiles. The final shield system, however, will be much smaller and lighter, as well as ruggedized for an airborne environment. The U.S. military has been interested in lasers, essentially, since they were invented. But one key hindrance has been the miniaturization technology necessary to create a powerful enough beam to destroy anything quickly. The previous failures included a $5 billion project involving a Boeing 747 retrofitted to carry a laser that failed in 2012. A photograph released by the Air Force shows the current surrogate being used in a testing is really, really, really big. We drop for a second. As the drive noted, it's unclear under what circumstances the Air Force conducted this latest test, such as whether the operators were given advance information on when and where the missiles would be launched and at what range and under what conditions the surrogate laser managed to take them down. It's also unclear what type of missiles were involved. Documents previously released by the government suggest that the Air Force is currently doing Phase 1 low-power ground tests, which would put the final product years away, but this is a precursor to a flight testing. While the system is designed for use on fighter jets, the U.S. military has plans to mount it on a larger craft. The drive wrote, the Air Force eventually wants SHIELD to be able to shoot down incoming air-to-air missiles, as well as surface-to-air missiles, providing an active defense for fighter jets during operation in high-risk environments. The service has already suggested, not surprisingly, that the system could also find its way onto larger, slower-moving combat and combat support aircraft, such as bombers, tankers, and transport planes, to mitigate the threat from ever-improving missiles fueled by steadily more advancing radars and other sensors. I'll drop for a second. It's hard to stress just how revolutionary a potted laser defense system would be for virtually any military aircraft, unlike expendable countermeasures such as hot-burning flares or radar-blinding shafts or electronic warfare systems. A laser weapon actively zeroes in on an incoming missile rather than simply throwing out some form of distracting noise to try and confuse the threat. A directed energy weapon also has an effectively bottomless magazine. However, limitations could include inclement weather and the inability for the system to target more than one incoming projectile at a time. The Air Force has some competition. The U.S. Army has tested an Apache AH-64 attack helicopter mounted laser system, potentially offering new capabilities like destroying equipment and disabling light vehicles without the use of high explosives. They've also used laser mounted on Humvee trucks to detonate improvised explosive devices from a distance. The Navy has also been developing its own system to be mounted on warships, where they could potentially take on threats like missiles or small boats. So much for Buck Rogers. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is EC2 Jet.
WS2N, it sounds like Star Wars is back, this Strategic Defense Initiative.
Yes, Paul, it sounds like it could be a press release that Ronald Reagan could have written. I guess if you throw enough technology at it, eventually you'll be able to do something with it. The problem, as I see it, is lasers require a great deal of energy. They're not terribly efficient devices. And the question is where you store all this energy. So I don't really see it as a bottomless pit of weaponry, unless you have a bottomless pit of fuel.
I agree, and I just saw the 747 with the laser, and it has, right on the nose, you could adjust its azimuth and elevation. And it was just on a documentary a couple days ago. I just watched it. All about the 747, and, all this. The trouble they went through putting together, and the Smithsonian Channel had it all about the 747. And one of the topics they didn't stay on it long, maybe a few seconds, just showed you that this was one of the uses. But I remember reading about it years ago. You needed so much power and fuel, and to operate this thing, and you actually needed a 747. That thing was actually I thought it worked. I remember they said it worked, but you said it didn't work back in 2012. So I guess it didn't work. But I thought the plane wouldn't be maneuverable. It was just a big heavy airplane to try to shoot down one or two missiles, and it wasn't practical.
Yeah, Paul, and they threw $5 billion at it. The problem, again, is technology is not quite on our side for these weapons. The efficiency of lasers are not good enough to be able to have them drop their mass appreciably so that they would be in more flexible situations, and the energy requirements require even more weight. So these things are massive, heavy, with great inertia. You know, go try and move it quickly with the weight that it's carrying, and it's going to be a mess. And even these experiments are testing actually lower size than they, a bigger size than they want, because they're planning at some point down the road to then shrink them somehow without undermining the energy output. So this is going to be a bottomless pit, I think. I think everyone saw Buck Rogers, and they want to be like him. So we're going to have laser beam, for the next, I'll make a joke and say it'll be available in 10 years, but it won't. Laser beams are real fascinating. People love laser weapons. It's in all the science fiction shows. So they're going to keep going to this place repeatedly for probably the next 30, 40 years.
Okay, maybe you know a little bit more about it. So why do you need all this energy, and what is it, just high current they need? What are they doing? Putting the current in through big coils, or why is this all so heavy?
Well, it's light amplification through stimulated emission of radiation. So the crystal just kind of acts as a synchronizer for the photons. You have to supply all the darn photons. That's a lot of photons. That's a lot of energy, and you have to discharge it quickly, which is a problem. So you need a high energy storage that's capable of a very quick discharge rate. They're both kind of compound the problem. So it's a mess. You have to realize, I don't know the number of joules that this thing needs to have to cut through the air and not be absorbed by atmospheric conditions and such, and that can actually blow up a enemy missile. But it's probably a heck of a lot of joules that you need.
Okay, so 747 was probably one big massive capacitor, and they're probably charging the heck out of it, and then, like you said, you need to release all that energy in one split second. Okay, I guess so. So now you have to run all these. You've got to get the power from somewhere. They must be getting it from the engines, of the 747.
I don't know the specifics of this experiment, but there are chemical lasers that get the energy from chemical reactions, and that's probably a better method, simply because electricity and capacitors just kind of have too many other problems. So if I was a guessing guy, I would assume that there's some kind of chemical method of generating the initial light that feeds into the laser system.
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic. Okay. I'm sure a lot of it is classified, but, you know, I don't know. If you search on the internet, you can probably find a lot of information about it. I'll do that. Good topic. Back to you, Roy.
Thank you, Paul. And on to the last topic. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, a little bit more than a month ago, I believe we spoke about a set of twins that were somewhere between fraternal and identical. Now, here's another story tonight in sort of the same vein. That's almost as surprising. A new mother in Bangladesh got quite a surprise a couple of months ago. Less than a month after she had delivered a healthy baby boy, she returned to the hospital and delivered a set of fraternal twins who, unknown to her, had been growing inside of a second uterus. Thankfully, all three children were delivered without complications. The double delivery was initially reported a couple of months ago by Agence France-Presse. According to interviews with the woman's doctor, the mom wasn't aware of her unique situation until she was forced to seek medical attention for a case of lower abdominal pain, and they gave her an ultrasound. Quote, she didn't realize that she was still pregnant with the twins. Her water broke again 26 days after the first baby was born, and she was rushed to the hospital, according to news accounts. Women born with two uteruses aren't unheard of. The formal name for the condition is called uterus didelphus. Estimates of how common it is are rather grainy, largely because many women experience no symptoms as a result of this condition, but it's probably very rare. One 2011 review, for instance, estimated that 0.3% of women in the general population had two uteruses. Some afflicted women do seem to be at higher risk for complications while pregnant or at the time of delivery. In this case, though, the boy and the girl twins were delivered successfully by a cesarean section with no additional difficulties. There actually have been case reports of dual pregnancies from women with two uteruses and even from one who also had two cervixes. And the triple whammy isn't unprecedented either. According to a 1981 case report, in that situation, the first two babies were delivered prematurely at 27 weeks, while the third took another 72 days to arrive. What makes this case especially notable is the lack of prior notice before the twins' birth. The mystery was one of human doing, not biology. Doctors didn't perform an ultrasound during the woman's pregnancy, which would have caught the extra babies. Quirky as the woman's story is, it has a troubling implication. The lack of ultrasound that's standard practice in countries like here in the U.S. is indicative of the poor healthcare system in Bangladesh and of financial insecurity many of its residents face, especially those who live in rural areas. And though the woman and her three children were all able to leave the hospital in good health, she is nevertheless worried about being able to care for her new family, given her husband's meager wages as a laborer.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
So the moral of the story is just because you gave birth doesn't mean that you're not still pregnant. Well, that's about all I have for tonight. Once again, I always like to mention this. If you have any actual mailbag questions, we still do mailbag questions if you're interested. Or if you have any topics that you would like me to cover, subjects, if you would like to make a point or refute what I said or point me in the right direction someplace else, the email address is mailbag@acs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And all of these stories will have links available. There's a very nice YouTube on the magnetic field of the planet that you can see. And they're all will be available within about 5-10 minutes at roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, thanks to everyone who participated and even to those who listened. And thanks, as always, to Dick and to Paul and the opportunity to do this. So I'll be back next week. I'll find some new things, and maybe I'll find a new puzzle. So I will turn it over to Dick so that he can turn it over to Paul. On second hand, I'll turn it over directly to Paul.
Okay, very good, Roy. This WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And we should have like a hint and kink section. We used to do something like that many years ago. And, you know, nothing to do with the space report, but, you know, I have a bunch of dipoles up, Roy. You know, I've always had dipoles for HF, and right now I have two. And one of them has a G5RB Jr., so. it's held up by a rope, like every other dipole. But one thing I did with this thing, it had a three-eighth rope, and I threw the rope, over the trees. About 3 years ago, I put it up, I've changed it many, many times, but this one I put up about 3 years ago. And the rope went into the throat of where the branch hits the trunk. I was like, that's okay, with the wind and everything, it'll be able a good place to move back and forth. Let me drop it. Well, about last week or so, I wanted to lower the G5RB. I wanted to tighten, the thing didn't look right where the connection was with, on the, where the, one of the insulators were. I couldn't move this 3/8 rope from that tree. There's no way. I mean, it grew around it. I didn't know that, but, I got a ladder and I was able to get up close to it. And I'm looking, this thing is completely encapsulated. There was no way I was going to get that out of this. I got a long screwdriver and it wasn't that high up, so I was able to do it on a ladder. And I chopped away, and I just wanted to save it. It was a nice rope, and I didn't want to just dangle in there forever. So I just didn't want to cut it. But, it really gets in there. So when you put up dipoles, it's got to go over the branch part, Don't get it caught in the throat of a tree. Incredible. I mean, and it was like 3 years. This is an old tree, by the way. Is that something, Roy? Back to you.
Well, I guess people normally kind of do it in the fork, so it adds more support. It's much more supporting in the fork, even though it's going to overgrow it. I can't think of any kind of simple approach to stop tree growth. It's not like there's some kind of deleterious material you can coat it with that'll retard its growth but not kill it. I guess if you can move it to a lighter branch where there's less pressure on it just getting absorbed into the matrix of the wood, that's a good thing. But, we theoretically should have all kinds of things like that. That's a perfect place for the tech reports in the first hour or such. It's just a shame that people aren't bringing their stuff for us here.
Yeah, very good. I know we used to do a lot of a Hinton King type of thing. And, that came to mind last week. Playing around with this, out of chance, it's always gone over the branch and good enough, come down and tied off somewhere. But this time it went in right by the, right by the trunk and where the main branch goes out. Yeah, that's good. Take forever before I have a problem there. It was 3 years and it's done. I mean, completely encapsulated. I couldn't believe it. I actually chopped it out and I was able to get it down. I know it doesn't sound like any big deal. You just cut it and look at the tang there, but I don't know. I'm not one of these people. I like to look at that. It's an example of what you shouldn't do. Okay, let me continue on anyway with the base report anyway. This is WS2M. Okay, first of all, before I forget, because it will get late before I know it. I left, I posted a link onto a roy.ac2gs website for what you could do is click on this link and it will, it's an asset link, so no advertisements or anything. And you bring it up and it will bring you to a website where you could put your name on this list, and your name will be put on with millions of other people by the time they're finished onto a little chip that will take a ride on the rover, the 2020 rover that will be going to Mars in the end of 2020, and will land in the beginning of 2021. and I did this, and it's interesting. They give you a boarding pass that you can print out if you want. But you know, I think it's great for anybody, or you know, especially if you have kids, grandkids. You know, you want to sign them up here. We'll put you on a rover, and we'll take a ride to Mars. So anyway, you can get to that by just going over to roy.ac2gs, and you'll see the link for going to Mars. Click on it, and then you just follow the instructions. You put your first name in, last name. Put your zip code in and an email, and what country you're from. It'll, you know, you go down the list. You find USA, click on that, and they'll immediately tell you that you're now signed up for this. They've done this type of thing before on other flights. Most recently, the InSight mission. I didn't do that one. This one I did. And I'll probably do future ones as well. I think the next big one is EM1, exploration mission number one. That will be the Orion spacecraft that will be launched on the Space Launch System. The SLS is the new Space Launch System that's never been launched before. That's bigger than Saturn V rocket that took us to the moon, and that will be a flight that will test out the Orion spacecraft without a crew. It'll orbit the moon and eventually come back and use the beach shield to slow it down. It'll have parachutes and land in the Pacific Ocean, and it will be picked up and brought back and probably put in the Smithsonian, knowing them. The first of anything usually winds up there. And with that, will probably still be your name attached to a good ship. So they'll be doing that in the near future. EM1 is what that one's called. But that's still a ways away. Maybe the end of 2020 would probably be the earliest flight. I'm thinking maybe even the early 2021 will be that test flight. They want to make sure everything works. You know, they'll launch from Launch Complex 39A, just like you had a crew on it. They'll go through TLI, which is Translunar Injection, and they'll go all the way out to the moon, go into orbit around the moon, and eventually deorbit the moon and return to Earth. So, you know, duplicate an actual mission. And then probably within a year after that, they'll do the exact same mission with a crew. And that's the story on EM1. Another flight that's going up in June will be another Falcon Heavy launch. There has been two Falcon Heavy launches so far. One that was a test one a year or so ago, February 6th. And that was successful, but all they had on there was a Tesla car. They wanted to put something on, you know, they needed some kind of ballast to duplicate an actual payload, and that's what they used. And then after that, there was another launch just a month or two ago of an Arabian satellite, communication satellite, that had to be put in space. And now there's another one. This is going to be for the Air Force. So it's a military mission, and they hired SpaceX to launch this thing. So most of that equipment, you know, that's going up, will probably be on the top secret side. But one of the things is that they're going to test green fuel. They call it a green fuel test satellite. Small satellite that's going to have a different fuel than hydrazine and nitrous tetroxide that they normally use, which is a hypergolic fuel. You mix the two together and it just ignites. And they have a new one right now called AFM315E, which is not really toxic at all, and it has higher thrust capability. You can actually have more fuel per volume. It's dense, more dense than what they use today. So they're going to give it a test out on a satellite, one of the smaller satellites that's going to come off of this massive military mission that will be launched on the Falcon Heavy. Let me drop it. So this green propellant will be something I want to see, because eventually NASA satellites will be using them, and eventually commercial satellites will be using them. I know Dream Chaser is already planning on using a green type of fuel. You know, hydrazine is highly caustic, and you know, it could cause cancer if you get it, you know, get it on you. And they don't need that. That's the reason that you used to see the space shuttle come back, and they used to land, and they had guys, they looked like spacesuits, they were hazmat suits that were working with the shuttle as they were trying to get the fumes away from it right after it landed. Well, that won't be the case with the new fuels. So, it's a step forward in the space program. We dropped this WS-1. And it's been scratching on my radio for some reason. Every time I transmit, that's on. All right, the calendar tells me that we're about 10 years away from the last rescue mission to the Hubble Space Telescope. And that was STS-125. Went up there for almost a two-week mission to save it. It changed out everything. It changed out the cameras, changed out. It added gyroscopes on board. They wanted to make sure they were all running right. The batteries, communication equipment, power supply. Actually, that was the mission that one of the astronauts, Mike Massimino, from New York, he was on it and needed to get a certain panel off, and to get the panel off, he had to get this handle out of the way. So they tried taking the bolts out. The bolts wound up stripped, and they finally decided to just break the handle off. Mission control said, "Just be careful. You know, you don't want any sharp edges or cut through your spacesuit." And it was successful. That's what they did, and they were able to get that panel off. They got the power supply and everything worked out fine. Since then, the Hubble has been functioning pretty much non-stop. We've had some issues. But if I'm in 2009, they would have been happy if they got 7 more years out of the Hubble. And here we are now, 10 years later, so 3 years past what they were hoping for. That was the 5th service mission to Hubble, and the last one, because after that, they said it was too risky, and the shuttles were being done away with at the time, and the last shuttle went off in 2011, a couple of years later after Hubble, and this mission came very, very close to not happening. Possible that we would not have a Hubble today. What happened was due to the accident with Columbia, when that thing burnt up coming back into the atmosphere, killing 7 astronauts, NASA was very worried in the future with the shuttles that were left to put them into space without going to the International Space Station. Columbia went up there, it didn't go to the International Space Station. It was just in orbit doing science missions, and then eventually came back and burnt up. They said if it doesn't go to the space station, we don't want anything to do with it. And when it did go to the space station, they used to do these pirouettes right in front of the space station, and the onboard crew would take pictures, detailed pictures of the thermal protection system to make sure the piles and everything was good shape before they decided to eventually end the mission and go back and go through the atmosphere and land. myself for the Hubble. He said, well, we're not going to have the space station to go to. It's in a different inclination. You can't just go from one inclination to the other. And plus, the Hubble is much higher, but it's around 350 miles up compared to the 250 where space station is. So they came up with this elaborate plan of putting two shuttles out on the launch pads. Shuttles used to launch from Launch Complex 39A, and then they had another one called 39B. And they averaged around half and half, you know, half the flights went off on one, the other half went off on the other. But it was the first time they had the two spacecraft out there at one time. They had Atlantis out there, and that was going to be the mission to save the Hubble. And then they brought out Endeavour. They called Endeavour STS 400. And Endeavour was just standing by with a crew on four, and in case anything went wrong with the thermal protection system. And they decided that they couldn't bring Atlantis back. Endeavour was going to launch within a two-week period, and it was going to go rescue the crew. And the crew of STS-125 was seven people, and the crew of Endeavour was four. So they had to put enough seats in Endeavour to bring back 11 people if need be. That would have been the most that ever came back on a space shuttle. So that's the story on STS-400 and the final mission to the Hubble, to save the Hubble. Any questions or comments? Okay. Let's see. Here's a story. I know Roy would like this one. There's a theory out there now that the moon at one time was hit with a 480-mile small planet. How they figured out that diameter, I don't know. But they think a small planet hit the moon at a speed of 14,000 miles an hour on the near side of the moon, the side that we see. And they've done all kinds of studies and everything. I thought it was very strange, but it was a reputable website. Unfortunately, it wasn't a magazine. Magazines are usually a little bit more reliable. But according to this, they really believe this happened. So I bring it up. I'm going to look into it further next week, see if they say anything further about this. Well, now, this happened, you know, millions of years ago. So they think at one time we had two moons, and one hit the bigger moon. Let me drop it. I had an update on Juno. Juno is a spacecraft that's going around Jupiter, and it's been doing that for quite a few years now. Very successful. It's in a polar orbit. One of the discoveries that it has made is that the magnetic field is shifting. It's going from, you know, one area to another in a relatively short period of time. They looked at the magnetic field from the original voyages, Voyager went past, also Pioneer missions. They made recordings of what the magnetic field was like, and you know where the north and south was. Now that they notice that things have changed, Galileo, by the way, was another satellite that spent for about 5 years orbiting Jupiter. But now you got Juno, and it's in a polar orbit. It gets very accurate measurements of the magnetic field. They find it's shifting, and they think that the magnetic field, the reason it's shifting, doesn't have to do with like what Roy was saying, with solid, you know, steel in the middle of the planet and molten steel around it. They think it has to do with the movement of the atmosphere, the very thick atmosphere. Apparently, Juno discovered that the atmosphere is much thicker, so it goes further deeper, much deeper than originally thought. And the movement of that, all that mass, is doing something with the magnetic field of Jupiter. And any comments or questions? get static on my radio. Why do I have static? I have a question. Why do I have static on my radio when I'm transmitting? This is WS2X.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, go.